This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. My name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Ha, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, it looks like Dr. Hawk is missing again this week.
Well, this is what happens when you sign a star. This is just what you have to put up with. This is what they do, you know what I mean? They have agents, and then the agent sends you a message about the contract and how it is that they can, you know, they don't have to report except till such and such a day at such and such a time. This is just how it is, you know. So we just got to put up with it, Nathan. It's just we do the best we can.
and of course, this has nothing to do with the toxic masculinity or the woman splaining that was going on a couple of shows ago.
So. Oh my goodness! No, all is well, and she'll rejoin us very soon.
Yeah, well, we miss you, Dr. Hawk, and we'll look forward to talking to you in a future show. Dr. Lyle, for this episode, we have a few questions, and they are directed to both you and Dr. Hawk, but we'll get your take on it. And if we need to get Dr. Hawk's take on it, I guess we certainly will. So we'll just take it right from the top. Dear doctors, are there some people more susceptible to addiction than others? If so, why are some people more susceptible to addiction than others?
I would say that there's probably two reasons that feed into this. The first reason is genetic variation. So just simply, we know that the way the genes are built, the way that genes build the psychologies of organisms, that certain people are going to be far more susceptible to, for example, alcohol addiction than are others. So we know that gene variation is involved. The question would be sort of how is gene variation involved? So there could be convoluted pathways by which this could take place. Now, I'm quite certain that there's a pretty sharp difference in reactivity to, for example, alcohol in terms of dopamine response between one set of people and another set of people. So some people's responsiveness is far greater, and they're far more likely to wind up being alcoholics. It's also true that alcohol and drug addiction or other addictions could follow their way through a different pathway. For example, it could be that they're more open. More open and maybe less stable. And maybe if you were to try to configure up a perfect personality for addiction, it could look like this. A really good configuration. Let's think through now for our own entertainment. Let's think through the big five plus one. Probably the best example would be low intelligence, high openness, low conscientiousness, high extroversion, high agreeable and high unstable. That individual, that is regardless of the underlying propensities to be addicted to a substance, that individual should be very, very likely to be addicted. The reason would be that they would come in contact with certain drugs that would be far, far more likely to develop an addiction in any nervous system. In other words, it would just build tolerance quickly. It would be very disruptive, something like morphine, for example. And so that wouldn't be that you had a particular genetic susceptibility to morphine or the opiates, and therefore you were more likely to be an addict. it would be instead that you had a personality that was more likely to have you playing around with that kind of dynamite. And so so your personality could impact you in that direction, or it could be that, I have many examples. I've worked with, I don't know how many people with addictions in my career, certainly more than 1,000. And I can tell you that their stories are not carbon copies of each other. There's wide variance in the stories. So, for example, one person may have been introduced to alcohol, you know, liked it, then drank more. Then in their 20s, they, you know, drank pretty hard, and everybody would go after work to happy hour. And then by their 30s, they're an alcoholic. They're in trouble. Another individual, and actually it was my very first case in my career, very first client I ever had when I was a student. So we're going back, you know, oh my God, we're going back more than 35 years. That individual told me that she knew she was an alcoholic from her first beer at about age 15 or 16. Okay, the impact on her nervous system was so striking that it was immediate. Okay, so that would be an example of an extraordinarily genetically loaded a nervous system that in no way could tolerate that kind of tickling to the circuits, whereas someone else might take years before they wind up in the trap. So the drugs themselves are traps by virtue of the fact that they are hyperactivating pleasure pathways, for example, and we will develop tolerances to them, and therefore there's a disincentive to get away from them because you have to go through a withdrawal process. So drugs will set a trap. But there is the individual differences responsible, but the chief issue is going to be genetic, and that issue is going to work through two possibly different pathways. Number one, how intense the pleasure response is to the individual's nervous system, and secondly, how open and experimentative and inherently sort of wild and undisciplined is the nervous system itself. That also is going to be a factor. So indirect and direct pathways, both genetic. I don't believe that there's any support anywhere for any environmental impact other than the fact that obviously if you live in a land where there's no opiates, you're not going to be an opiate addict. But essentially, the access to all these drugs are more or less ubiquitous in the United States. And so we would expect that, you know, people that are susceptible to these things will find their way there. And if they find their way there, you know, if you take a line of cocaine, you decide to do that because you're sufficiently open or you're too agreeable and the party and the cool people are doing this and you're there and you get encouraged, you better hope against hope that you're not a genetically loaded coke addict, because that could be a very, very devastating mistake, okay? For many people, it won't be. In fact, for most people, it won't be. But most is not all. And some people, I have had people that from their first line of cocaine, they were in deep trouble behind that. That's all it took. So anyway, that's the answer to that question, is that the fundamental reason is genetic, but the way that the genes may play into this may have different pathways.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I found most striking when I read The Pleasure Trap for the first time was how you compared the dopamine rush from, say, cocaine mm-hmm. and that of an orgasm. And it was like, mm-hmm. 10 times greater or something like that. And it was just astounding. Like, I remember you saying in a lecture, like, can you imagine just how rewarding that would be?
Yes.
Compared to, you know, 10 times more.
Yes, actually, it's actually endorphin, not dopamine. So the at orgasm, there's a phenomenal endorphin storm. So that so you can imagine that exactly orgasm would be the most intense endorphin storm that would naturally occur to the organism, and yet you can go far past that with some drug, for example, with an opiate, and so you can understand, whoa, super 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 dangerous, and You could expect a lot of people get into a lot of messes behind having that kind of experience. It's just something. This is where openness is so dangerous around this. I've had many friends who are very open and tried various and sundry drugs and wound up with intermediate level problems or no problems at all around monkeying around with sort of garden variety drugs. But they all knew, you know what? I'm drawing the line at cocaine and heroin, and I'm not going to do that. I'll smoke marijuana, and I've had some people that do some mushrooms and maybe even with the dynamite that is LSD, but drawing the line at things that they were intimidated about and they were worried about their addictive propensities. Yeah, that's just some IQ and some conscientiousness saving somebody from a disaster, but it won't always do it, okay? So this is IQ, conscientiousness, emotional stability, openness, agreeableness, extroversion, introversion, all in a swirling cauldron of vectors that, in a given location and time, in a given culture, that's what's at play here. So we're not going to find necessarily a super linear, simple answer, but the most linear answer is genetics, genetic variation, either through the general personality of the openness, or the specific individual responses of neurochemistry to a given drug.
Yeah, I remember, I've been in a few party situations where I've been offered some hard drugs, and I remember telling somebody, I'm curious, it sounds interesting, but I know myself. I'm going to be under the Golden Gate Bridge, not knowing how I wound up there in a matter of months if I ever do this drug.
Yeah.
And it was the fear of doing that.
Yeah, well, good for you. I went you one better. I wasn't cool enough to be invited to the party, so therefore I escaped all such threats. All right.
I wasn't invited back, though.
There you go. All right.
All right. Our next question. Dear doctors, in my husband's family, several members are bullies. Even my husband will join the bully pack if there is any indication that they might turn on him. I'm highly agreeable and conscientious and find that I'm often the target of their bullying. What would you say is the best tactic to use with adult bullies in families?
Well, the best tactic is to not get in any conversations with them about anything that is controversial where they disagree with you. Okay, so that's clearly what's taking place here. So whatever the deal is, she's got some positions on things. This is known. There's a disagreement in the pack, and now we're getting some ganging up behavior on her. So the first move is don't be controversial around a bunch of disagreeable humans. The second thing is, if you can do it at all, avoid them altogether, as we talked about last time. You've only got more or less 100,000 hours to spend on Earth. Nathan, you may have 200,000, but I'm probably down to my last 100,000 waking hours, where this is what I had to do. And so the quality of my existence in this life, how at the end of it, what was the score on a 1 to 10 scale for my average life experience? Well, that's going to depend upon, what choices I made to be located where. Who was I interacting with and what was I doing during these 100,000 hours? And believe me, now that I was talking to Alan Goldhammer the other day, we both turned, 60 in the last year. And I said, we feel great and we can still play some darn good basketball. We can pretend like we're 45, but we're not. And the truth of the matter is, it's 3/4 of the way over in all probability. And so we talked about that. We were kind of joking about it, but taking it seriously. That for us, we're in the late in the 3rd quarter, and the 4th quarter, might be great. It very very well could be. Might be the best part of the game. We don't know. We're certainly investing in our health, so we're not going to hopefully have a lot of discomfort or negative surprises. So we hope that we are able to, as Alan puts it, live till we die. But But the thing is that when you live as long as we have lived, you do realize something that is not, we're not really cognizant of when we're under 40, which is that your time is limited. It really is limited. And, you know, it's one thing to hear old people with gray hair talk about this and you sort of nod your eyes and roll your eyes, but it's like, guess what? This is really true. Your lifespan is remarkably limited, and it's not some grand, you know, big scheme that you're trying to figure out. No, it's the hours right in front of you, okay? It's this day. This day is just as valuable as any other day of your existence. And so the hours that are in this day, you've got 10, 12, 14 hours to do some things. Are you enjoying the process? Do you like it? Are you interacting with the people that you like and you love? Are you doing something that you enjoy doing? You know, is this an enjoyable process? And if it's not an enjoyable process, it's important to look really hard about why. And usually the first place that we can look is, what is our social ecology? Who are we interacting with? Okay. I like to interact with people that are friendly, funny, happy, you know, that like me a lot, and we have a good time. That's it. Okay, if you're not one of those people, or that you are sincerely interested in my opinion, and I'm trying my very best to help you, and you know, and that's how that works. So this is how I build it. And if that isn't what it is, I'm out. Okay. Obviously, sometimes I'm going to wind up in professional situations where, you know, I'm not really enjoying this thing this much. I'm at some conference and I'm supposed to be there, and now some people are coming up to me and they're jawing about how they disagree with me about something. Not an enjoyable process, and I'm going to have to just manage it or whatever it is. There's going to be, you don't have total control over every minute of your life when it comes to this regard, but you've got a lot of control. And so if there's people in your life, quote, these bullies, or God forbid, I don't know what this husband is and why he's joining the pack. So we'll leave that question for some other day or consideration. But the point is that what are we doing in a discussion with people arguing with us? That we know they're going to argue with us because they've done it before. We know what their behavior is. They're very disagreeable, loud, bombastic, pushy, whatever. We're not going to convince them of anything. They're not going to convince us of anything. The whole damn thing is unpleasant. So why are we there? Okay, so think very carefully. Why on earth are we showing up to that Thanksgiving? Why are we there? Why are we going to the brother's birthday? Why? Really drill down through this and try to figure out, why am I spending three of my very precious 100,000 hours driving over there, hanging out with these people for an hour that I don't like, and then leaving? Why? Well, because it's my husband's brother's. So why doesn't he go? If he enjoys hanging out with them and going to their birthdays, then let him go and you stay home. Oh, well, that's going to be a big strife in the family. Who cares? Go out and enjoy your existence. They'll have a better time without you there. So this is how it is that I look at things. That, you know, when it comes to your free time, I mean, you got to work for a living, most of us. Most of us have to do things, and a lot of times in that doing things for a living, there's things that are unpleasant, you know, uncomfortable, you know, that we might dislike doing. You know, we've all done a lot of those things. So, you know, I can't say that, you know, if you like to do plumbing, every hour of your existence plumbing is going to be a joy. Sometimes it's going to be a real, you know, really uncomfortable and unpleasant. So it is. Same thing with doing anything. If you're a surgeon. So we don't expect our work life to be, you know, necessarily filled with joy. It may be, and hopefully it is. But we may not be able to control or change that well. But our social life outside of that, are you kidding me? You're in 100% control over that. So that should be spent with people that you like and people that you love and people that you respect, people that you enjoy their presence. That's who it should be. And if it's anybody else, take a really hard look at that, because as far as I'm concerned, those are weeds in your personal garden. Okay? Pull them. Get out of there. You know, there's just no need to be spending your life. So how do we deal with bullies? We just walk out of the room and never even show up in the room in the first place. That's probably a better answer.
Wonderful, Dr. Lau. Thank you so much. I really love it when you get passionate about this. It really shows us how much you care about this.
It's, sure.
It gets me all fired up too. Like a soldier joining battle.
That's right. There you go. All good. All right. What else we got?
All right. Our next question. Dear doctors, what attracts people to others from different ethnic backgrounds to themselves? For example, some people, I assume, are obsessed with people from Scandinavian countries. Other people may prefer people from Asian countries. Alternatively, why are some people so against being with someone from their own ethnic background, while others may only want to date people from their own ethnic background? I say this from my own experience, which is I am of Southern European ancestry. I have dark features. I am physically repulsed by women with those features and helplessly drawn to women from Northern Europe with fair physical features like blonde hair, blue eyes, etc., pale skin. It's so frustrating as this makes it very hard for me to meet women, as women with fair features are in the minority where I am. I wish I was drawn to women with dark features, as there are so many more of these women in the world.
It's a fine question. I would say if you are repulsed by the people around you, then, and you're drawn to people with some other characteristics, then by all means, you should be doing everything you can do to plot to get where you need to be. I.e., this is what I call fish where the fish are, for goodness sakes. So whatever can be done to facilitate that situation is what should be done. In terms of the broader question about why this is true, nobody knows right now. We know that the answers are going to be in the genetic code, but we don't know specifically why. We certainly know that we know a great deal about attractiveness and what draws people to, what makes people attractive. What would make people attractive to one genre of attractiveness as opposed to another genre of attractiveness is not known. So, for example, there are women who like guys that are tall and slender and that maybe they'll play in the NBA, and they're 6'6" and they're 220 pounds or 210 pounds. So they're athletic, but they're slender, okay? On the other hand, there's going to be women that are going to be very attracted to some guy who's 6 foot tall and 200 pounds, more like a sort of a classic boxer out of Ireland or something. In other words, just tough as anything and strong as an ox. So what accounts for that difference? Answer, who knows? Okay, so these are the same thing with, from time immemorial, the different configurations of female, the different patterns of female anatomy, that some guys are attracted to one thing being larger, another thing being smaller, etc. These are individual differences that are very likely to be genetic and probably not likely to be subject to be local input from media or anything else under the sun. It's probably not learned. Now, it's interesting that when it comes to women's preferences, that appears to be less true. Women can be essentially discover that some guy that they really liked had certain features, and now it turns out that they didn't used to be attracted to those features before, but now they're more attracted to those features. That's something that apparently takes place in women, and I don't think that it has been discovered in men. So that was sort of an interesting finding when women's preferences were analyzed. That doesn't mean that they're infinitely flexible, and it doesn't mean that they don't have typical, preferences that happened before any experiences that may be sort of bedrock or baseline preferences that don't change. So the point is that these are very likely to be genetic. Some of the issues about being drawn to people outside your gene pool versus inside, a lot of possible reasons come to mind, but one of them would be openness. It's also true that there's in this species, women have a draw to actually leave the village and get away. You probably want to get away from your gene pool because you don't want to be mating with first cousins or even second cousins if you can help it. You're probably better off getting, you know, away from sort of the family group. And so that may be a characteristic. That characteristic has been found in many animals, and it may be true of people. I don't know that that's been established in people. I don't think it has, but it's suspected by many evolutionary thinkers that that could be the case. A derivative of that characteristic would be to be attracted to people who are different. Okay, so that don't look like us. Facial configuration a little bit different, bone structure a little bit different. In other words, let's just try to get, you know, let's try to find people from the other side of the hill that have a little bit different breeding stock than us and have been, you know, they used to be relatives of ours, you know, 130 years ago. They used to be pretty close relatives. Now they're not. They've got their own settlement over there. There's been half a dozen generations have come and gone. Now, of course, we share a lot of language so we can talk to each other, but we've got slightly different ways that we pronounce who we pray to. It's a little different, slightly different ideas about that, and we look slightly different. Okay, so you can see that finding people slightly different could be genetically useful as a characteristic. And so you could see that if that is true, if there's a chip in our head that says slightly different is better than more the same, at some level the contrast increases the attractiveness, then you can see how that chip could be in some people far greater and more dramatic than it is in other people, like this gentleman that wrote to us. So he could, you know, he could be essentially an outlier on that particular dimension, and he wants to be looking at people who are very different than he is. And you can see how that could be, you know, a very obvious genetic variation that could take place. So, you know, otherwise, why? Well, I can't point any further than that logic. I will bet a great deal that the reasons are ultimately in the genetic code. And so that's, you know, that's not going to change. So therefore, since it's not going to change and it is you, my attitude is, you know, tunnel your way to Stockholm. Do whatever it is that you have to do to get there. If you're not there, find a way. Find a way to get there, or to, I don't know, Los Angeles. They're not. They may not be genetically blonde there, but they're blonde. So what the heck?
Now, I heard a long time ago in terms of pop psychology that you know, men and women may go through phases where, like, you know, in a certain part of their life, they're attracted to this particular race or ethnicity, and then they get over that, and now they go to more societally conventional, whatever it is. So whereas, you know, it sounds like what you're saying is, you know, the symmetrical face is really what's going to do it, and then the ethnicity or the other things are just more genetic as far as interest. What do you say to that, and what's your thoughts on it?
Oh yeah, that's all just bogus pop psychology. There's no truth in that. It goes obviously beyond the symmetry of the face and the body. It also goes to that you've got fitness indicators that are on the body that we are looking for. So beyond symmetry, there are other characteristics in addition to symmetry that can really significantly increase or decrease someone's attractiveness to another individual. So you can imagine, let me give you an example. You can imagine the very effeminate, breathy voice of Marilyn Monroe, which you may not, Nathan, because you're too young. But that was an extraordinarily striking, very sexual characteristic. And so the height and method of speech and the height of the pitch, all these kinds of things, and probably even some of the the tone and the delivery of the voice probably was similar to how people might talk, you know, across a pillow in low voices. So Marilyn Monroe, you know, like some other extraordinary specimens, you know, really had it all. I mean, so did Elvis. I mean, Elvis was unbelievable in terms of how the guy could move and sing and how handsome he was. So some people come loaded not just with symmetry, they come loaded with you know, 99th percentile fitness indicators in a given dimension, whatever that was, whatever those dimensions are. So Marilyn had that, Elvis had that. That's why these guys are, that's why they're still being talked about, you know, 50 years later, 75 years later. I mean, that's why, is because they're so striking. And so I forget what on earth your question was. I've totally lost. What was it? What was your question?
Oh, it was just about the first one was about the pop psychology, which we threw that out. And then that you were saying there's something, it's not just the asymmetry of the face.
Right. It's a whole constellation. And yes, but the issue of attracted to others and how different they are and how different they need to be. And it's not just different, obviously. So this guy is drawn to the light skin, blonde hair. So are a lot of people. You know, some people aren't. Some people are very drawn to dark skin, dark hair. I mean, that's how that works. Ironically, I had a long conversation. Unfortunately for this guy, it was me having the conversation instead of him. I had a long conversation with a very intelligent, very beautiful young blonde Northern European who is very attracted to dark-skinned, dark-haired men. So quite an interesting conversation. And so it's like there it is. I was getting literally the mirror image of the same story, and it was kind of a curious wandering around about kind of why and when it happened and, you know, when it was noticed in her development, etc. It just is the way it is. This is human nature. And in her case, it wasn't the only style of men that she was attracted to. She's also attracted to, you know, young, tall, thin, blonde, you know, good looking men from Europe as well. So, but the point is that she also had in there a bit of a preference and tendency towards exactly what our writer is. So it's a big old scramble, and you don't know who on earth that you would appeal to, given who it is that you are. But you do know that if you have some group that you're strongly drawn to, and you're nowhere near that group, then do what you can to get there. There's no, you know, whatever the hassle it is, it's probably worth a try.
Well, may the gods bring those two people together someday.
There you go. Very good. All right.
Our next question. Dear doctors, people get physically less attractive as they age. They also become less fertile to the point of being completely infertile. What happens when looks and the prospect of sex are no longer appealing due to age-related decline? And how does evolutionary psychology explain attraction at this point in life and beyond?
Yeah, sort of a bunch of sort of loaded, interrelated things. So let's try to talk about this from maybe a few different perspectives. So it's certainly the case that as we age, we're going to be less attractive. That's true. And it's also the case that to some degree, as we age, we're going to be less interested in sex. That's also true. Interestingly enough, that's going to be more true of women than it is of men. And ostensibly, we don't know why, and we can't necessarily pin this exactly on biology, but I don't know, it may already be known. I don't keep up with every new discovery or every new study that is under the umbrella here. But I do believe that we know that there's a pretty significant sex difference, that men's sexual interest is going to decline less precipitously than women's, and that women's declines pretty significantly postmenopause. Now, I can already hear that we've got women saying, well, that isn't true for me, blah, 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 blah. Of course it isn't. I didn't say that it all closes off and goes to zero, but it's a main effect of being a female is that there's going to be less interest. It would make sense that would be true, by the way, as we take a broader perspective on the evolutionary problem. If you can't reproduce, why would we go to the trouble of going through reproductively relevant behaviors? So one answer might be that I had my last child at 46, at the very last edge of my fertility, and that child is now, you know, 10 years old, and I'm continuing to try to get resources out of my Parabon partner as I'm now 56. And so one of the ways to do that is to be bluffing him that there is still a possibility of future children with me, and he's attracted to me, or he wouldn't have been interested in the first place. And so I happen to have the features that aren't as alluring now as they were when I was 46 or when I was 36 or when I was 26. But I still have some of those features, and I'm tickling his nervous system enough that I can keep him around. And therefore, I need to be sexually interested enough in sex in order to keep him around so that he will continue to invest in our 10-year-old child. Okay? So essentially, you could look at postmenopausal sexuality in women being a bluffing mechanism to try to continue to get resources out of males. That would be the deep evolutionary hypothesis that would be involved here. That wouldn't mean, of course, that there was any conscious process going on there at all. I wouldn't expect there to be. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about deep unconscious programs that could have driven continued sexual interest in the female even past the point where there would be any possibility of her reproducing. So that it could be that that's just all bogus, and that in fact all you have is, once you build a machine to be sexually interested, then you can't shut it off. Like, it's more trouble for evolution to shut it off than it is to just let it idle along, even though it wastes time and energy. I tend to think that the first explanation is probably a lot more likely. So I think that there is a reduced interest, but there is some degree of residual interest probably there to try to keep males in a pair bond and keep provisioning the last children for a while. So that's how I think that probably works. For the males, I would expect that the decline of interest would be less. And I think that's probably true. I think we could probably establish that with survey research pretty easily. So, what was the rest of the question? I forgot.
The rest of the question was about how does it explain attraction at this point in life and beyond? What happens when looks and the prospect of sex are no longer appealing due to...
I'll tell you what, you know, when you lose, it's possible you can lose enough attractiveness, potentially from your age, that you're really not appealing to anybody, at which point sexuality is out of the game for you. And that's an unfortunate state of affairs, but most of the people that are in that state are probably, you know, by the time you have some guy old enough and crotchety enough that he is he's of that age and has no appeal, he probably doesn't have a lot of testosterone and a lot of steam in the engine anyway, mercifully. And the same thing is true with women. If they get old enough that they no longer have any possible appeal, and they also are and they have very low sex drive associated with it, also we wind up with a situation that isn't really too unpleasant. It's also the case that something else that you will sometimes see is that you'll see couples that particularly that have been, if they've been happily together for a long period of time, as they age, they often can maintain sexual interest in each other even as their attractiveness from the general public has declined quite a lot. That's because they seem to be able to see right past the aging cues. In other words, because they have known the person when they were younger and a lot more attractive, those characteristics of that attractiveness are still being registered by the admirer on the other side. So this is a beautiful and merciful possibility to humans, that they could be both, you know, 78 years old and still attracted to each other. And that can happen. But if you're trying to hear from me the story, or anybody wants to hear the story, that it all, you know, has some beautiful, some beautiful, magical, spiritual, appropriate design, that it all winds up just as happy and we can, everything can be just as great at 70 as it was at 30, the answer is no. Okay, statistically, that is not going to happen. More people, of the people that would still have some sexual engine and would have some sexual interest, those people are going to be typically a lot less attractive than they ever were, and it's going to be harder to find people that would be interested in them, and it's going to be some increased frustration as far as that goes. And that's okay. A lot of us are frustrated with this problem our whole lives, so what's the difference?
It sounds like even more of a reason to take your advice as far as not squandering the hours that you have at your prime, your peak, or close to that.
Well said. Okay, so yeah, try to do a good job at enjoying your existence, and don't let other people and institutions and expectations of anybody else waste your life. Okay, we've got a limited number of hours on Earth to enjoy this gift that we have. Let's really do a good job at making the best of it.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.